Welcome at our talk about automating incident response scalable and fast within minutes. My name is Zawari Doné. I work as an incident responder at Hunt & Hackett and have had experience of a background in DevOps and incident response. And I've also worked as a cybersecurity consultant at NFVR, one of the sponsors of Hacker Hotel, and as a DevOps engineer and developer. And I'm here with my colleague.
Hi, I'm Matthijs. I work as an incident handler for almost a decade now. I've been in cyber. I have not that much of a technical background necessarily. I have a background in criminology and crisis and security management. And worked at Fox IT before. That's where I learned the trick of doing forensic investigations and managing crises. And with that expertise, we would like to take you on this journey today. Rest assured, we're not going to talk about artificial intelligence.
What?
So if you were hoping we would, then this is still the moment for you that you can leave. But we can neither confirm nor deny that ChatGPT has been used to confirm or to create some of the slides that we will be presenting today. That being said, we incident responders, we are special and we are very unique and we are super good at what we do. If not, we are the best. Our capabilities might not be required for every situation, but when the need is high enough, then you can call us and we will be there. We will come and get the job done, and we can definitely not be easily replaced. And sometimes we can be high maintenance. But are we really this super special, unique concept car that not everyone needs or can afford? Or are we actually more this guy? Or maybe even this guy? Or this guy? Are we more the mechanic that is asked to fix a specific task? That is responsible for a specific part of the engine and keeping that specific part up and running? Or for the machine as a whole maybe, but definitely not the design, the strategy, the way it looks. We just need to fix what we are tasked to do. We need to fix the problem at hand. We need to find the attacker, kick them out. That is our task. We do it well. We are sure to create innovative solutions on the engagements we have at clients. And we fix problems. That's basically what we do as incident responders and as incident handlers. But is that really innovation? Fixing the problem right before you? Is that something you can call innovation? We've all had engagements with clients where there's hundreds or thousands of systems that need to be acquired, sometimes even manually. It's a very iterative process, taking the investigation steps. It used to be all manual, a lot of work, taking your machines apart, acquiring them, putting them on servers in a lab environment and starting to investigate them. There was a lot of work. And we all worked with clients where, you need to assume they are incompetent, right? Because otherwise, why are we here? You need to help them because they don't know what to do. Incident response is not part of their business. We are there to support them in a way. And incident response is a part of our business. So we need to make it easier. For us as incident responders, we don't want to keep acquiring all these machines, these hundreds and thousands of disk images. We don't want to process them manually. It's so much work, takes a lot of time. We don't want to do that. So we want to make it as foolproof and as easy as possible for the clients and the organizations we are helping. Don't be afraid, you can come in. But also for us, as the incident responder, we want to make our lives as easy as possible as well. So, what then are we exactly trying to fix? Well, the way incident response was done is rooted in digital forensics. And that simply doesn't scale well anymore. The frequency and the scale of cyber incidents all over the globe results in that incident response teams are facing significant challenges with security incidents. So the traditional approach where you have to acquire large amounts of data over several days and process that before you can actually start investigating just doesn't cut it anymore. the large-scale enterprise incidents or large-scale enterprise investigations, that approach doesn't work anymore for those type of incidents. So also, nobody wants to perform processing by hand. It's just too prone to errors and needs to go over and over and over again. And well, you don't want to do it for this case and the next case and the next case and the next case. Just doesn't work that way anymore. And this is part because, well, there has been a lack of strategic innovation. The incident response and forensics industry has not been innovating as much as we want to, not in a strategic way at least. Sure, we create tools, we create parsers, we create short-term solutions for the issues at hand, but long-term strategic innovation, where do we want to be in 5 or 10 years as an industry, hasn't really happened as much. And it makes sense why that hasn't happened, because it's what we call the perverse incentive. Because if you have more investigators going on an engagement that use more hours and more time to do the investigation, you can bill the client more money, and the organization makes more in doing it that way. On the other hand, development and innovation also costs time, and time costs money. So by innovating that industry and by innovating the way you work, making it more efficient, you actually make less as an organization. So that's why there hasn't really been an incentive for organizations to do so. That's what we call the perverse incentive. So we definitely do short-term, as an industry, we definitely do short-term technical innovations, create cool new parsers, write cool new toys and tools to find this specific artifact that is hidden somewhere deep inside the file system. Sure, that happens, yeah. But we need to make sure that we bring innovation, the innovation mindset, to the more business side of the industry to move it forward. So, what does that mean? And Zawadi is going to tell a little bit more about how he does it in practice. But what it means from a mindset perspective is we decided to embrace the DevOps mindset in our incident response team. So that means come up with a strategy. A strategy for innovation. Where do we want to be in 5 or 10 years? How are we going to make sure that we still work as efficiently, as reliable, and as fast as we can? How can we make sure that we have feedback loops, for instance? We want to have repeatable methods. So if we create investigation steps or analysis tools for a specific investigation, we want to make sure that they are implemented durably in our environment so that we can use it for this case, but also the next one, and the next one, and the next one, so we don't have to do it all over again. So we need to have that strategy to ensure the repeatability of the investigation steps we take. We want to make it sustainable. No one-time fixes, no. Whenever we're on an engagement, somebody comes to me with a problem and he says, "Yeah, Matthijs, sure, I can fix this." And I said, "All right, how much time do you need?" "Maybe half a day." I said, "All right, how much time do you need if you want to fix it now and forever?" He says, "Yeah, maybe a day and a half." Said, "All right, take your day and a half, because maybe it takes more time now, but it means that we gain that time in future engagements." To do that, you need feedback loops. You need to identify issues and create reusable parsers and improve based on feedback from the initial result. So that's where the DevOps mindset really comes into play here. Because then you can feed the feedback you get from whether it works or not into a strategic roadmap and make sure that you implement for the long term. And if you do that, you want to validate as well. So it's nice that you collect investigation data, process it, analyze it, but how can you be sure that the parser actually parsed everything you are expecting to find in your investigation data? Did the tool really work? Does it process everything you wanted it to process? Or maybe are there valuable artifacts missing during that automatic processing of investigation material? So validation of investigation material is crucial, because that will ensure the reproducibility of your results as well. Finally, by automating and incorporating this DevOps mindset, cross-team collaboration becomes easier as well. Because we automate a lot, including the parsing and the parsing of investigation material into timelines, for instance, we can also ask less experienced investigators to come work with us. We can ask threat intel analysts to come work with us. And well, by automating and incorporating this DevOps mindset, it comes much more easy to work with other team members. And that ultimately, well, makes your work easier, doesn't it?
I would like to start with a question. Who here does incident response? Not a lot. Okay. And who uses an incident response lab for performing incident response or uses various commercial forensic tooling? Yeah. Use? Okay. Only two people. Okay. In setting up our cloud-native incident response service, as the company started in 2022, we had the benefit to start from scratch and based on previous experience from previous employees and environments where we have performed forensic investigation, we determined our certain key principles on how we want to build our incident response lab and the software that we used to do that. So we started by building reliable services that work independently from each other. And we want to have an incident response lab that is available anywhere across the globe. We are currently located in The Hague in the Netherlands, but our goal is to perform incident response in every region possible where our customers are also located. And next to that, we also want to improve the scalability of our lab, which can be scaled based on the demands of an incident response case. So that means that if a customer has 1,000 systems, you'll be able to do that. But also if the customer says, I have 10,000 systems anywhere across the globe, in different regions, in cloud environments, but also in on-premise environments. And then next to that, I think is one of the most important key principles of how we do incident response, is that we want to support different kinds of tools and data sources in an agnostic manner. And we don't want to comply to only use a tool that we like, but we want to use the right tool for the right job. And in addition, our lab should consist of segregated environments for different investigations, because that ensures that data and operations are contained and cannot interfere with each other. And at last, compliance is also important for the legal persons by ensuring that environments can be governed and deleted in a GDPR compliant manner. So that means, for example, if a customer asks us to store investigation material for 5 years, we can do that. Even for 10 years, it's no problem, because we can use the scalability of a cloud service that has unlimited data storage. So that's about the key principles. We also want to let you know that for us, a tool alone is not a solution, because in the last couple of years, we have seen that a lot of new incident response tools have been published. A lot of people like those tools and use it for their investigations. But I believe that a strategy is needed to use those tools, because you don't want to end up with only a hammer, because there are jobs where a hammer is not the appropriate tool. And that's one of the reasons that our incident response lab consists of a lot of open source tools that have a lot of different benefits that we can use during our investigations. So 2 years ago, I built an incident response lab as shown in the diagram. It was for a school assignment. As shown in the top left corner, there are failure disruptor clients that can be used on Windows, macOS, or Unix systems to collect forensic material, for example, the MCache, Windows event logs of Windows systems, but also syslogs of Linux systems, which can then automatically be collected into the incident response lab. And normally, people do manual forensic analysis by grepping on the file system and looking for traces that could indicate if an attacker compromised the system. But for this project, I use Plazo, which is an open source forensic tool that can convert forensic artifacts and logs to a timeline of events, which then can be analyzed in TimeSketch, which is a collaborative analysis platform. But we determined during the first year that I worked at Hinton Hackett together with Matthijs that this was not enough for us, because it was not scalable enough, was doable with 10, maybe 20 systems, but if a customer had more than 20 systems, the investigation wasn't really doable in minutes, hours, or even in a week. So during the last 2 years, we leveraged the project and the knowledge that we have to build a new incident response lab, which looks like this. With much more tools and a scalable foundation. And this is a cloud this is an incident response cloud lab based on the Google Cloud platform, which can be used to perform incident response in a scalable manner, which means that we can collect a variety of data sources shown on the left. So this is not limited to system data, but could also includes memory, Active Directory objects, data from hypervisors, firewall logs, and all kinds of other data sources, which we then automatically process in the lab, as shown in the middle, using various forensic tools like the DISAC Incident Response Framework, which can then convert, for example, a syslog on the Linux system to a structured data format in the timeline, which can then be ingested into Elasticsearch, which is an open source database, after which we use timescales to perform manual forensic analysis, like by performing database queries and determining where the attacker was in the network. But with Jupyter Notebooks, we also further automate our work. So we create Python code that we can reuse during new cases to perform forensic investigations, which also improves the repeatability of our investigations, because as analysts, we can share notebooks with each other, and by that way, we can share the knowledge from an investigation with somebody who was not there during that time. Because we don't want to be in a situation where we have one great team member that has all the knowledge, and that when that person goes on PTO and is not available, that the other analysts say, Pete is on PTO, so he cannot really investigate Linux systems because I only have experience with Windows systems. So this ensures consistency and reliability in our processes and has been the new foundation of our incident response lab. As mentioned, we like to automate a lot of stuff. So we leverage infrastructure as code to automatically provision our incident response lab using various tools shown on the left. And using this method, we can streamline data acquisition, processing, and analysis with only 5 lines of code within 2 hours. So previously, this took for us like a week or maybe 2 weeks, depending on the investigation and the investigation material. But using this method, this only took one, I think the biggest case only took 1 day because our processing platform can scale based on the amounts of systems that we have to investigate during our cases.
So, for example, this is all fun and games, theoretical analysis of how it should work, when actually the only limitation is money, because if you need more power, you just hit the plus button, and the bill goes up, but so does the processing power. But let's say, for example, you have a customer environment. There's various compromised machines within that environment, and you want to collect material from those machines, and you want to upload it to the lab. Well, we use various tools for that, and the entire flow from acquisition of systems onto our incident response lab is automated. How that exactly works, of course, we can't tell you. But we'll leave something a little bit. We'll leave a little bit to the demo as well, because Awadi will show you a little bit better, a little bit more of how this works. But what we essentially do is we acquire these systems and we upload them automatically to our lab environment. This also makes it a lot easier for administrators on the client side, because we don't have to explain to them anymore how to do it. We just say, here's a PDF, here's an executable, double click. Can you double click? Yeah? All right. Do it, and everything will be fine. And then the process, and then the pipeline starts, materials acquired. Doesn't really matter if it's a remote system or if it's in a data center or if it's a laptop, doesn't really matter. We can acquire it, upload it to the lab, and then we process it over there. So how do we do this? How do we do this? Well, we will now discuss three fairly critical ways of data acquisition, or data source acquisition actually, being the acquisition of memory, the acquisition of virtual system through a hypervisor, and how we use Velociraptor. Velociraptor is, up until this point, you could call it the star of our show, because we use it quite a lot actually. Because actually has dual capability. It can, on the one hand, be used for data acquisition. You can acquire a subset or an entire machine, but you can acquire a subset of specific forensic artifacts that you want to upload. Essentially, one could argue it functions as a C2. But we use it to acquire forensic artifacts and log sources. But you can also use it for threat hunting and monitoring. If you have it installed on a system, you can use it to actively, kick off investigation rule or kick off rules or threat hunt on a system. And we use that. Well, why? Because it's fast and it scales really, really well.
So we have talked about file system forensics, acquiring various file system artifacts. But besides implementing automation at scale, we are also interested in innovative subjects that improve our incident response capabilities, because a system consists of way more than only a file system. The memory of a system is just as crucial to gain an overview of all the activity that has taken place on a system. And in addition, a lot of the advanced persistent threats that we are hunting for have been utilizing memory to subvert investigations. By employing techniques like file anti-forensic, fileless threats, kernel rootkits, which often leave no traces on a file system, which results in incident response teams that perform only file system forensics that miss crucial traces of an advanced persistent threat that could still be in the network. And in response to these threats, we believe it's important to broaden data acquisition beyond the file system and to include the data acquisition of memory as a standard process into the incident response capabilities of an incident response team, because it offers a comprehensive view of a system and the activities that have taken place, and reduces the chance that you miss crucial steps during investigations. Who here does memory forensics, or has ever done memory forensics? Five people.
How many of those find it fun?
Nobody finds it fun. Yeah, it's a hard job. There are not a lot of tools available to do memory forensics on scale. So that's also something that we want to improve into our lab. So the methods that we described thus far involve actions that could alert existing persistent threats, shown on the right. A user network of a client has a few of hundreds or thousands of virtual machines. And while an APT performs various actions on these machines, like initial access, lateral movement, persistence, or for example, command or control, the normal incident response teams then run tools on these systems, which can be detected by the advanced persistent threat, which could result in an APT escalating the incident by, for example, damaging systems or stealing data that was part of their objective. And we believe, as a team, that when we do incident response, if it is not needed to alert the APT that is active in the network, we would like to employ techniques that could be undetectable from an APT. So if there are virtual machines on a hypervisor that are being attacked, we leverage hypervisor collection of file system data and memory of virtual machines, while the APT remains unaware of the investigation. And we do that using the acquire, which is part of the Dissect incident response framework that you can run on a VMware ASXE hypervisor that can collect file system data from virtual machines that are running on the hypervisor. So while the APT is employing all kinds of techniques in the hypervisor, it cannot be aware of the activities that are performed by the incident response team. And this is also something that we want to improve on, and which improves our undetectable data acquisition methods that are part of our incident response lab. So we have explained how we do data acquisition and a few parts of our innovative subjects. But I'd also like to ask, who here has ever created a forensic parser? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5? Okay. And was that parser part of a framework, or was it just a Python script that is laying around somewhere on the system?
Quick and dirty.
Yeah? Okay. Yeah, so I already talked about the Dissect incident response framework, which we're already a fan of. And I would now like to show how we try to prevent to have those Python scripts laying around and to improve not only our capabilities to do forensics, but also those of the community that are part that also use the Dissect incident response framework. So usually investigation starts with a system, for example, a Linux system with all kinds of log files. And usually, I think most of the persons use grep. Am I right? Yeah? You grep the data. It results in unstructured data. It's not it's repetitive work. It cannot be improved. And it usually is results in unstructured analysis. And what we try to, what's bad about this is that you have to do manual work over and over and over again. So at the next investigation, you're on PTO, your colleague sees the same logs and has to write the Python script over again or use your old Python script that is not maintained by any employee in the company. So what we are a fan of, as Matthijs explained, is feedback loops. So when we discover a new data source during our investigations, we write a parser for it that converts it to a structured data format. And by that, we can improve the parser, fix bugs, and add more structured data to a timeline of events, which then results in a happy analyst that can perform a structured analysis. And by contributing these parsers to the community, we can secure our knowledge within the company, but also within the incident response community that can also use these tools during new investigations. And in such a manner, we leverage feedback loops to feed the knowledge into parsers, playbooks, but also other repeatable methods that we use during our investigations.
Yeah, it's all funny games, but now it's been enough with all this talk. How about you show me how it works?
Yeah. So we have a demonstration of our incident response lab, and we will show how the first hour, 2 hours of our most of the investigations that we do look. So in this example, we have a customer environment with all kinds of systems, memory. It is an Active Directory environment on my hypervisor. And imagine this customer has 25 systems, just got ransomware, and just had one question: when did the attacker get into the network, and what kinds of techniques did they execute during the time? Was data exfiltrated, and what did they do? So we have a processing platform that can automatically process the data that gets ingested, what we will show just now, and how fast we can do it. So there's a timer on the top left corner that shows, which gives an indication of how long this takes.
You also made it into a video, but we didn't really want to challenge the demo gods, you know?
So it usually goes like this. We're almost 20 minutes into an investigation. We have acquired 25 forensic packages of Windows systems that just got ransomware and attacked by an attacker. After that, 10 minutes later, our processing platform already automatically starts virtual machines on the Google Cloud platform and automatically parses these forensic packages to timeline of events. So we're 40 minutes in the investigation. The processing is ongoing or already done. And then the analyst can start with doing analysis using various methods, which includes manual forensic analysis using TimeSketch, but also automated forensic analysis using Jupyter Notebooks. So in this case, we've done quite a few ransomware cases. We can use old notebooks from old ransomware cases for new investigations to determine if old techniques have been used by attackers that are currently deploying ransomware and environments. So it looks like this. We have more than 200 million of events in TimeSketch. We have 25 timelines of events. which contains events or files that have been created, Windows event logs, executables that have been executed. And by leveraging TimeSketch, we can use the Kibana query language and determine by, for example, using the Windows event log provider, has the value struct, the executable, been executed, which then returns a structured data format, which contains a timestamp and a data type. And then we can start with tagging these events. For example, if the event is bad, we can tag it with bad. If it is good, because an administrator executed some tests that look like an attacker, we can tag it with good. And if it is suspicious, we can tag it with suspicious. And this we can all do within 1 hour without any human intervention. So we give the customer some executables, they execute it, we go lay down, have some drinks, and 1 hour later, we can start with our investigation.
For those that don't have a lot of experience with doing traditional incident response, it used to take 3-4 hours per disk to, well, take it from the machine, put it on in your acquisition, or in your imager, and then all the way up until the processing. It could take up to 3 to 4 hours per system. So you can see how much faster this goes.
Yeah. So that was the demo. As we have explained, we have built our lab based on open source software. We use a lot of open source software packages, like shown on the left for data acquisition, and shown in the middle for processing and analysis. So we also like to thank everybody that is contributing to the open source community and that has contributed to these software packages, because we are quite happy that you did. We're also happy that we can contribute back to the open source community, because this way we better understand how our software works, and it's also easier for us to validate our findings from our investigations. Because sometimes it happens that we have findings that are like not real, and then you validate it, and then you find out there's a bug somewhere in the a Linux implementation which causes IPv6 addresses to be interpreted as IPv4 addresses. So if your customer is located in the Netherlands and you have an UNTP log with data that says no, there was logged in from South Korea, it could be a bug, because yeah, that's how it works with software. So yeah, therefore we'd like to thank everyone that has contributed to these tools, and we also like to show that not all the work that we put in the incident response lab was by ourselves. Like, I think most of the part was done by the community of these software packages. Yeah.
So, of course, we've talked about the rationale behind it. We've shown you how it works, and just to summarize what we want you to, what we hope you take away from this presentation, is that by incorporating a DevOps mindset into your incident response practices, you can make your life easier, because by automating you eliminate startup time, and you can in doing so facilitate scalable forensic investigations. Automating processes and automating the way you organize your tags and tagging, and it helps you also for IOC-based detection. Something we are still working on this year is see how we can automate that part as well. So have our cyber threat intel platform feed into our cloud lab to do some of that suspicious or bad tagging for us, to make our lives even more easier, that we just have to look at what is tagged. It makes it easier to investigate many machines at the same time. Of course, when you have to investigate like a single or maybe two machines, we understand. But for the enterprise, large-scale incident response investigations, this really is the way to go. Because automated, accelerated detection and scalable analysis of the investigation material will reduce also your margin for errors. Because, if you validate that whatever you put in is also what you expect to come out, if you have your validation mechanisms in order, then you will reduce the margin for human error, at least. Because computers usually don't get tired. They just break, but they don't get tired, and humans do. So they can make errors, ultimately. So automating is also a way to prevent that from happening. It will help you, therefore, if you can investigate faster, come to findings faster, and come to conclusions faster, you can also help contain the incident altogether faster, which is ultimately in the best interest of the organization you're helping as well. You can identify compromised systems much easier and therefore focus your remediation steps on those systems quicker as well. This helps in identifying or coming to the root cause a lot quicker, which will help you wrap up an investigation quicker as well. You can move on to the next one. So, finally, I believe this is everyone's favorite task in the cyber community, reporting and documenting whatever you found. It will become easier as well, because you have a lot of the tagging done for you, have a lot of the processing done for you, the methods are repeatable, and you can retrace your steps quite easily. So even reporting becomes a lot easier. Also because you can work together on reports. So to conclude, we strongly believe that if you incorporate a DevOps mindset into your incident response practices, form it into a strategy, your business becomes much more resilient, and you can come to final conclusions, resolve cases much faster, more efficiently, and with less margin for error. So scalable and repeatable investigation steps in automated detection, they ultimately will make your life as an analyst a lot easier. Why do I know this? Well, because we at Hunt & Hackett, we are doing it, and it did make my life a lot easier, and it made incident response ultimately a lot more fun as well. Thank you for your time. We went through it pretty fast, so if you have some questions, we do have time for that. Go right ahead. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we preserve our evidence. We keep it in buckets, what we call. We keep the original investigation material that is uploaded. We copy a version of that. And the moment it's uploaded to our material, we create hashes. So we always have the original material that is provided to us. And, the timestamp it was uploaded, and then the timestamp the processing was started. So at my previous employer, I had these paper forms that I had to write down. I even had to manually write the hashes, copy the hashes that were created of these systems. I was like, come on, are you kidding me? And I have to, I'm taking the disks from the storage, putting them in the computer right now. Because we do it in the cloud and we do it digitally, we have a lot of these timestamps, we already have them. And based on, the client needs, we can store data either for a year or up to 5 years, as long as you want. But not every engagement requires that. So we can really make it tailor-made to the organization's need, really. And we always provide the opportunity for organizations to download all the original material at the end of a case. We can also say, we can do it for you and store that information for you if you want. So by doing that, we do it that way, actually. The persoonsgericht, the personal investigations at this point. But yeah, if we would have to provide the proof of the integrity of the material, that because that's essentially what it is, then it would be admissible, yeah. Yes, definitely. What do you mean? Invalidate? What does it invalidate? Yeah. We create forensic packages of the relevant log sources. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. It depends on the type of investigation you do. Because when you have a ransomware incident response investigation, the goal of the investigation is entirely different than when you investigate, let's say, a fraud case where money was stolen, then the approach would be different. But securing the material and having the original investigation material, get the hashes, and then process it in your lab environment, yeah, sure, there's no reason why that would not be admissible in court. On the target system, you mean? Oh. What if the question is, what if the systems are BitLockered, right? Yeah, we would of course need the BitLocker key to, how do you say, decrypt the volume, because otherwise it's just scrambled data. We could also acquire the disk and then use the key later, right?
We can acquire a disk of a BitLocker encrypted disk and then using a BitLocker key to decrypt the data in our instant response lab.
So ransomware. Yeah, then usually the file system is encrypted, but rarely ever the OS disk as well, right? Because otherwise the system won't boot and you won't see any ransom note. So ransomware usually does not encrypt the entire system, including the OS disk, am I right?
Yeah.
No, you can usually still reach the system from a central point in the network. I need to repeat the question again. If you cannot reach the system because it's encrypted, then what do you do? Well, usually if the system itself is encrypted, it can still be reached from, let's say, a central point in a network, or maybe even physically. You can go to the system, plug something in, and then make a copy of it. The question is it super relevant to investigate the system, or would you rather focus, let's say, on backups and investigate them, see what happened right before the point of encryption, and see if you can restore those? So the question is it really relevant to investigate that system? Are there any other questions? Yes. This is more of a philosophical question. Maybe you can hand the mic to him.
That's better.
So I have a more philosophical question. With automating tasks, you're obviously alleviating menial tasks from humans to computers.
Yes.
So my question is more like, where's the line? Like, where do you see the task of the human as opposed to the task of the machine?
Well, I personally, I see it as my task to click on yes if I want to start the processing pipeline. Then see if anything breaks. That's also still my task, or Zawadi's task. And then at the end meaning when the material is processed, I still see a task for the human to investigate that. At this point, I would ideally have an LLM that does that for me as well, and then feeds me back the results, right? And then I just, well, trust but verify. So I need to check if the outcome, and validate if the outcome is what I expect it to be. But yeah, for me, I would say I would love it if I could have a machine be a junior analyst and then I just check its work.
Yeah, but we validate a lot of our results from our analysis platform, and even using automations, we identify new bugs in the automations. So we are not relying on them and blindly trusting the results of the tools we use. I think in the last year, during every investigation, we found at least one bug. In our software, but also software that under other companies develop. So
the ultimate goal would be to shift things more towards DevOps as opposed to be on the analyzing side. Ultimate goal speaking.
Yes. So we would like. Maybe I can show you that slide.
I don't know if you heard AI talk recently, but it still sounds kind of crap. So. Ultimately, someone will have to present those findings and discuss what it means. So there will always be a role for an analyst.
I don't have a slide of it because we only use it internally. But our eventually goal is that in every step of this process, there is a validation function that validates if the result of this task was correctly executed. So if you, for example, have a Windows system where you would like to acquire Windows event logs, we first want to verify, are the Windows event logs that are configured in the registry really located on the system? Because if an attacker deletes the security event log, and at the end of the investigation, we determine, oh, you have not seen any logon events, yeah, that's a mistake. So in every step, we would like to validate, was the task executed correctly? And then we want to feed that to the analyst so that the analyst can determine, okay, how did that happen? Was it a bug in our software? Was it an attacker? Or was it another mistake that was made during the process? So yeah, it's a combination of validation and using automations to make our work more easier.
To keep the human in the loop.
Yeah, if I reduce the amount of work I need to do per case, doesn't mean I want to work less, I just want to do more cases at the same time, right? Yeah. You had a question as well, right? Oh, wait, the mic is coming. Be careful.
Thank you. My question is about most of your slide, even you show VMs, hypervisor, you talk about memories.
Yes.
But with the current world that we have ephemeral systems, things are disappearing. Scaling out, scaling down.
Mm-hmm.
Is it going to make a problem for your investigation? And do you have any tips for those company prepare themselves?
I'm sorry, I don't think I understand the question.
Okay, so if the pod in the Kubernetes, you scale it up and scale it down, it's going to disappear,
Kubernetes,
right?
Yeah.
So it make it difficult, in my opinion, for investigation.
Yeah.
So do you see that as a problem? And do you have a tips for people to prepare for an investigation?
The first tip is store all the logs that you can store somewhere in a bucket or a hard disk. But Kubernetes and Docker included have a lot of features that you can use for forensic investigations. So the framework that we use, you can even use it to replicate the terminal that the attacker was typing in during the attack. Because Docker stores all those commands and executed executables on disk. So the eventual goal is to make backups of the systems that you use. This, for example, the Kubernetes nodes, but also store all the relevant security logging of Kubernetes itself and the containers that are running on it on a different system that is not part of that prediction environment. So
do something about it.
Some are by default enabled, but most of them you have to customize it for yourself or use a tool to do the job for you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. But there are a lot of cool forensic projects in the cloud native community that facilitate this role.
Oh, the mic is on. Mic's on its way. Or if it's a short question, I can just repeat it.
So how would you handle a system that's not connected to the internet to get sources?
Interesting. If it's a system that's not, the system doesn't need to be connected to the internet to acquire it, right? I mean, I do need to have access to it physically then. If I cannot connect it to it over the internet, it's fine. If it's also not reachable over the network, which I think you mean, because if I can reach it over the network, it's also fine, because then I can go through the network to that system, acquire it, write it to a file location, and then from there find a way out. If that's also not possible, let's say an air-gapped environment, then I could still take a disk, walk over to that system, plug it in, acquire it, write the disk, bring it back, put it into my internet-connected machine, and upload it to the lab. What we've also did is create an offline version of the lab. We had an investigation where it was required because the client said, no cloud. I do not trust it. Okay, that's a strategic decision. You can have opinions on that, but we had to build an offline version of the lab. So we did, and it worked. So Adi wasn't really happy about it, but it worked. Does that answer your question? Anything else? Yeah. If the question is, if there is a specific reason why we chose Google Cloud. Zawadi, why did you choose Google Cloud?
Okay, I'm a Google Cloud fanboy, so.
There you go.
No, I used Google Cloud during making the first assignment, my school assignment. And I started working in Hinton Hackett, and we're already using Google Cloud. So that's the reason that we started using Google Cloud. But I believe you can recreate this environment in AWS or Azure. I wouldn't advise it, but it is possible to recreate the environments, even in an on-premise environment. But yeah, it takes more work to do that.
Any other questions? Right, then thank you and enjoy the weekend.